Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
Good evening, everyone. Tonight, our speaker is Les K, and the title of today's talk is The Princess Loses Her Head. Welcome, Les.
Thank you. Well, I'm very happy to see all of you tonight. I think many of you must have curtailed holiday travel plans and can't be with family, but this is a good place to be as an alternative, to be with each other, to be with our Sangha. So I'm glad to see you all. So I think all of you know, I think all of you understand that in Japan, when young monks are trained in the monastery, when they go to the monastery, their training is quite strict. We all understand that. There's a tight discipline. There's a very precise schedule. There are rules for the way to do everything. Very prescribed ways of doing even the smallest tasks, including bathing and using the restroom. And if a monk breaks any of these rules or is casual in how he or she does something, he can be scolded very harshly or even punished. And one example of this is the use of the stick during zazen, or what they call a kyosaku. A senior monk will slowly walk around the zendo behind all of the sitting monks. And if he decides that a monk's posture is a little bit slumped, or if he determines that the monk's mind is wavering, he hits the monk on the shoulder with a stick. And there's a loud smack, a loud noise. And everyone else in the zendo hears it. And so, of course, immediately postures become very upright and straight. So the monks who live in the monastery are very dedicated, and they expect this sort of discipline, and they accept it. They know that if their posture wavers a little bit, they may get a smack on the shoulder. And this form of discipline is a form of wake up. It's to wake up the monks. It's a discipline that's applied, by somebody else. It's a discipline applied from, I will say, outside oneself. And it is intended to help with practice. It is not a form of punishment, although it might look like that to the outsider. It is part of the training in the monastery, training the mind to be alert and to not wander. Now, of course, here in California, here at Canando, the use of this stick, the use of the kyosaku, is not appropriate for us. Totally different culture, totally different motivation to practice. And we started out many, many years ago using the stick, as Suzuki Roshi showed us, but we learned very soon that it just was not appropriate for us. We have the stick. We haven't thrown it away. It lives on the back of the altar and it stays there. So we have a layman's practice. And our practice is mostly in public life, not in the monastery. We are not secluded monks. We have work to go to and we have families to take care of. And this has changed the motivation of our practice, the emphasis. We do not rely on somebody else to apply motivation, neither with a stick nor with anything else, or with enforcing the rules from outside. We make our own rules ourselves. We rely on our own personal determination and our personal effort. We don't rely on somebody outside of us to push us to do right practice. We determine it for ourselves. And this is an important part of the foundation of our practice for today. So at Kanando, we did put away that stick many years ago. And personally, I feel that it is a better way. It is better that we learn how to encourage ourselves, to find our own way to maintain awareness and to return to awareness based on our own experience and our own initiative, rather than from being hit with a stick from a monitor. So in the Zendo, we emphasize paying attention to our breath so that we can be aware of the movements of our mind. And in the quiet Zendo, where there's no activity, it's an ideal place to develop awareness and to develop attention. But in our daily lives, it's not so easy because there's so much going on. It's not hard to lose our awareness moment by moment. But there are many different ways that we can remind ourselves to return to our awareness. And we are continually exploring those. So a Buddha said to his disciples at some point, find your own way, make your own discoveries. And this admonition, this principle has not changed. This is the foundation of our practice. We make our own discoveries through our own effort. And I had a particular experience about making discoveries that I'd like to talk to you about. When Suzuki Roshi first came to San Francisco, and Zen practice first came to San Francisco in the early 1960s, all of us who were involved in those very early days, especially the people who attended San Francisco Zen Center, there was a lot of interest in the things Japanese and in Zen culture, a lot of interest. We hope to learn something about the practice by absorbing the cultural items. So we took a great interest in offering incense, in wearing beads, in shopping for tofu, in eating ramen, in wearing sandals. And something that became very popular pretty quickly was green tea. Up until then, coffee was the drink of choice, but Zen students became interested in green tea. And when Suzuki Roshi had guests visiting him in his quarters in Zen Center, he always welcomed them with a cup of green tea. And the first time I had a chance to meet with him privately, he did offer me a cup of tea. And I discovered that its flavor is very subtle. It's not sweet. It's not spicy. Does not have an exciting flavor like some teas might. Instead, it had a calming effect. So I was interested. And so I asked him how you make it, how do you brew it? And he started to explain. He says, well, you put some loose tea in a little teapot. You boil some water and you let it cool a little bit. And then you pour the hot water over the tea in the little kettle. And then I said, well, how long do you let it brew? And he didn't answer. He just shrugged his shoulders. I felt that his silence and that his gesture meant more than, you know, I don't know. Sometimes when, you know, you ask somebody a question, when they ask you a question, you might say, well, I don't know. And you shrug your shoulders like that. But his gesture was not saying, oh, I don't know how long you brew the tea. I felt he was saying, you have too many questions. You should experiment with tea. You should have trial and error. Have your own personal experience with green tea. I felt that this is what his gesture meant. And ever since those early days, back in the 60s, it's been my habit to start my morning with a cup of green tea. When I get up, I start the hot water, start the water boiling, and I get dressed for Zazen. And of course, this was in the recent years where we did Zazen in the physical space of the Zendo. So I would dress for Zazen, preparing to go to Kanando. So many years ago, I got up one morning, I poured the boiling water over the tea, and I went to dress for Zazen at the Zendo as usual. And I forgot. I forgot that the tea was in its pot brewing. And when I finally remembered, and I quickly ran to pour the cup of tea, and I took a sip, I discovered that it was very bitter, of course. And it was a bit of a surprise because the tea is usually very mild. And of course, my surprise told me that I had not been paying attention. I had forgotten that the tea was brewing. In the very short time between pouring the water into the teapot and putting on my robe to go to the Zendo, I had allowed my mind to be distracted. I had not stayed aware of the tea even for a minute. But when I took a sip of the cup of tea and felt its bitterness, that bitterness woke me up. It was just like being hit on the shoulder with a kyosaku. The bitterness was a wake-up call. Pay attention. Did you ever, when you were out driving, did you ever get a ticket for not stopping at a stop sign? And you say, either to the officer or to yourself, oh, you know, I didn't see it. I didn't see the stop sign. But after you get that ticket, you will pay attention to your driving. Well, that you'll pay attention to your driving until the bitterness of that experience fades away. Then your driving may revert back to be very, very casual or relaxed. The disappointing experiences in our life can feel very bitter and can taste very bitter. But they do help us bring our mind back to awareness. So that day, many, many years ago, the bitter taste of the tea got my attention, and I did not easily forget it. I didn't dismiss it. I remembered that bitterness, and I remember that bitterness today. Although I'm pretty good now at not letting the tea go too far. But the bitter taste of that green tea years ago was a reminder of how easily our mind can be distracted. So when we see that kind of experience from the standpoint of our practice, we realize that the bitterness is not an enemy. But the bitterness is our friend. And so I'm grateful for that quality of green tea. That it can become bitter if we don't pay attention. If on that day I had been drinking sweet tea, I would not have recognized my mind's distraction. When we experience bitterness in our life, it can bring life to our life. We all experience problems that are created by forces and events in our life that bring disappointments. But most of these are beyond our control. So the disappointment is not bitter. These unexpected and unexplained difficulties that come up can be painful. They can even cause suffering and sometimes grief, but they are not bitter. They didn't arise because of our own lack of attention. Bitterness arises when we fail to give our full attention to a situation or to someone. Or when we fail to give our full attention to a disappointment or a problem. We can experience the taste of bitter tea on our tongue, but the real taste of bitterness is remorse. Remorse that occurs when we drift away from what we had to do. So like bitterness, like the taste of bitterness, the feeling of remorse, which is painful, a feeling of remorse is not necessarily a bad thing. It can be helpful to us. When we feel remorse, it means we are accepting our role in what happened, and we are sharpening our mind. As we learn, from the experience of not paying attention. So remorse can help turn bitterness into sweetness. So sometimes we do need bitterness to wake us up, like being hit with a stick. And there's a story from ancient China that I'd like to share with you. It's about a very beautiful princess who was very vain and self-oriented. Every day she would sit in front of a mirror with her attendants, and she would admire herself, and she would try to make herself more beautiful, and she would spend hours combing her hair and having her attendants comb her hair. Long, beautiful hair that her attendants would spend hours combing out. The maid wasn't very pleased by having to do this every day. And one day she got very annoyed at the princess, and she took the mirror and turned it around so the backside faced out. When the princess sat down at the mirror, she couldn't see herself, and she thought she had lost her head. And she ran around shouting for her lost head. Where is my head? Where is my head? And she ran outside the palace, and she ran through town shouting, where is my head? Where is my head? Eventually, the townspeople felt that she had gone crazy, and they locked her up in the stocks, where an ancient device that would hold your head down and keep your hands in place. They put her in these stocks to settle her down, but she kept sobbing, where is my head? Where is my head? Give me back my head. Finally, someone walked up to her and slapped her hard in the face. And that made her realize her head was still there, that she had never lost her head. So she calmed down and became happy. And then the people let her go. And from that time on, she gave up admiring herself. So what should we do when bitterness occurs in our own daily life? We should not spit it out. We should not make a face. And we should not complain. If we created the bitterness through our own lack of awareness, we should taste it, let it dissolve, and we should learn to swallow it. And the most important thing, we should let it wake us up like a slap in the face, or as if we were being hit with the kyosaku. And when we have an opportunity to do that same activity again, this time we make a vow to pay attention. So it's easy to learn that we need to take care in preparing green tea or it becomes bitter. That's easy, but sometimes it's not so easy in the activities of our complex daily lives. But this is our practice, staying aware and being totally involved in everything we do so that we don't create bitterness. So while we are not able to go back to Kanando, while we have to keep it closed because of the situation we're in, we should keep a Zendo attitude in our life, even though we cannot be there. We should continue to practice and keep our body and mind in awareness, just as if we were on our cushion. Thank you. And so we're open for questions if you have any.
Dave?
Thank you so much for your talk, Les. of course, I'm sure we're all familiar with what you said about the Buddha saying, you know, don't depend on external authorities, you must find your own way. On the other hand, I think there is a sort of a slippery slope sometimes. I remember hearing a few years ago someone talking about an unfortunate tendency that she detected in sort of late 20th century Americans to pick and choose different pieces of Asian religions and Native American religions and Christianity or Judaism and just sort of cobble together their own personal religion, which really came out sounding really kind of narcissistic. And what she was talking about was that there's considerable value in respecting and paying attention to wisdom traditions that have been around for a long time. Not necessarily following things slavishly, but striking a sort of a balance. The thing that I'm thinking of specifically here is when we chant the English translation of the Sandokai, and there's one passage in there that has always kind of gotten my attention. It says, hearing the words, understand the meaning, don't set up standards of your own. And I'm just wondering if you can help clarify a little bit where the edge is there between taking responsibility and initiative for our own practice and setting up standards of our own.
I think that admonition to not set up standards on our own refers to don't let your ego get in the way of your relationship with other people and how you should behave with other people so that there is harmony. Setting up standards on our own, I believe, refers to staying in harmony. Let's all follow the routines and the procedures and the standards that we need to in order to continue being harmonious. Don't do anything to upset that because of your own personal desires. It's an interesting saying, but it does not mean give up all your creativity when you feel you have something to contribute that can benefit everyone. It might even result in creating a new standard. But I think it that expression means go slow. When we have a new idea, let's be mindful of it and be careful of it and go slow with it and make sure it will not upset the routine that we've developed to keep us in harmony. And when we feel we've done that, when we feel we're not doing anything without being aware, then we can go forward with some new idea and have our idea be shared by everyone. So we no longer consider it, we don't consider it to be some special thing that we created. Let it be the creation of our community. This, I think, is the spirit of practice. Anyone can have a creative idea for improving the way we do things, but we try to do it in such a way so that everyone feels it's everyone's idea and not just the creation of one person. So in future years, that person can say to others, oh, back in 1998, we created this new way of doing things, rather than say, I created this new way of doing things. It's a matter of ego and a matter of having a communal feeling. I'm glad you brought that up, Dave. I've thought about that admonition for a long time. And I believe that's what it means.
That makes a lot of sense, Les. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Oh, it's Diane.
Hi, Les. I was pondering a question. I hadn't quite come to Gassho yet, but I love the analogy of the bitter tea and the bitterness and feeling remorse. And it certainly takes a lot of awareness to turn that into learning and seeing yourself. And while I agree totally that we are responsible for our own practice and our own awareness and shouldn't look outside of ourselves, I just want to go back to the stick, because I remember the stick in the early days. And I never thought of it as a punishment. And I also remember you or other priests coming around and helping us with our posture, especially if we were in a sesshin. And it was really helpful, because when I was new to practice, I wasn't always aware of my posture. And while I had to develop that myself, it was helpful once in a while when someone came around and corrected the posture. And then when you're sitting for a really long time in a sesshin and your shoulders are so tight, I always thought the stick was to help relax that muscle. At least that's the way it was explained to me. So I just have to say, I never thought of it as a punishment, but I could see where it could. You know, how do you find the balance of that? Or do you have to totally do away with some of those old Japanese things, which I personally like, but maybe it turns other people off?
Well, we took a different attitude to the stick. Some of you may know the story that I've told a few times. When a Kanando was not yet at Rock Street, when we were still back on College Avenue in Mountain View in a very small building, we did use the stick. I mean, hit on the shoulder. One morning, I did that, and one woman got up from Zazen in tears and ran out, crying. And when we spoke to her later, she said, I was abused as a child.
Yeah.
And the sound of that stick on somebody's shoulder woke up some very painful memories for me. And so from that time, we decided that we're not going to use the stick in that way. But we decided to use the stick in another way. Rather than use it to smack the shoulder. We use it as a way to correct the posture. We take the stick and put it up against somebody's back and help straighten their spine this way. And so the stick was used in a much more gentle way, much more used as a guide rather than a something to hit with. So that experience, that bitter experience with that young woman running out of the zendo, taught us something about the nature of practice and how would we be better off practicing a little bit different, a different way here in this culture.
Mm-hmm.
One with some feeling and less regimental. But we haven't used the stick in any capacity for a long time. We could go back to using it if people think it's helpful.
Mm. Good. Thank you.
It feels good to be quiet tonight, quiet and peaceful with all the turmoil that's been going on. I hope that tomorrow is peaceful for all of you.
Les, I don't have a clearly defined question, but when you started the story, it reminded me of a different story that's a similar, but a little different. And I believe it was one of the women ancestors where she was, you know, very beautiful, very wealthy, and she was taken, I guess, to the Buddha. I mean, this is all allegorical, I guess, but she saw... the Buddha showed her a woman even more beautiful than her, and she had never seen one. And then she saw the woman grow old and start to decay and become very, you know, ugly. And she was horrified, but she had a wake-up experience, and she actually became one of Buddha's disciples. And I read about it in one of the ancestor books, and I can't remember which one it was, but the story you said reminded me of that. It was like a bitter awakening, because before that she had always been recognized for her beauty and was then relating to people in that way. And then when she saw it all like it doesn't last, then she started searching much deeper. And I just wondered if you had heard anything about that story. It just reminded me of that one.
No, I didn't know about that story. Sounds good.
Yeah. I think I read it in a woman ancestors book, maybe Women of the Way. I think that's where it was.
So yeah. In that story, it was the Buddha who made the other woman go from very beautiful to old and elderly.
Yes.
Should we all have the Buddha's powers like that, or are we better off as we are?
I'm not sure how he did that. I'm sure it stories evolve over time. Yeah. Maybe he told her a story, but it turned into
We know he didn't have a video.
No Photoshop either. Anna? Oh, and then Columbine after Anna.
Thank you for your talk, Les. Your story about the bitter tea reminded me of some advice you gave me a long time ago about letting people learn to help themselves instead of always trying to help right away, that we have that tendency and it's important for people to learn how to do that for themselves. And, you know, this has been such a hard year, and so I was wondering about, you know, letting people learn from that bitterness and also explaining things the way Suzuki Roshi didn't explain to you all the details of the tea. I think in our culture, we have so much information now that we have a tendency to say, go here and do this and get to give all the information. So how could we balance those two things right now, especially with people being a little bit more isolated, to have that urge to help and have that urge to explain. How do we find the balance?
We just have to be aware of a situation. In some cases, we do need to offer our help immediately if help is needed immediately. But in some cases, we can sense that this individual will be better off learning over time and through their own experiences rather than be told something specific. We just have to know. A fireman knows to put out a fire now. And sometimes we sense that we need to put out a fire now. But sometimes we sense that let my help be like a garden. Let me help nurture this situation and let it grow on its own. And let me not try to make it bloom all at once. So it's a matter of knowing that, being sensitive to a situation or sensitive to an individual and what they really need right now. So in that story when Suzuki Roshi told me about tea, he did give me a very, very specific instruction at first, but then he sensed that I'm not going to give this guy any more specific instructions. He needs time to figure out the rest of it on his own. So it's up to us to be sensitive and aware to the situation we're in and what situation the people that we are with, what situation they are in. And we get a bit wiser every day in that aspect as we sit. We tune our awareness and our attention. And so we learn little bit by little how to respond and when to respond and what kind of words to say and when to be silent and what kind of gestures to make. It all unfolds as our practice unfolds.
Thank you.
Thank you, Anna. Columbine.
Hi, Les.
Hi.
Hi. So I guess this was more just comments about, so I guess what kind of struck me as surprising was that you said that when we're distracted, we might have remorse. And I could see that naturally from somebody who was practicing Buddhism and was aware and then maybe like you described, but it felt like most people who are distracted, like just regular people, don't have that sense of remorse necessarily. And so it seems like it's more of a sense of maybe dissatisfaction. And I guess, well, two things. One thing, watching other people being distracted and not really knowing what, like, if they do feel dissatisfied, not knowing how to help them, kind of. That's one thing that I wonder. And then mm-hmm. I guess the other thing is, for me, now that everything's on a screen right now, and there's less, you know, like human, I'm having a really hard time not being distracted. And I'm a very, in general, a very focused, you know, never had distraction issues in the past, but especially with everything being on a screen and feeling so virtual to me and not real, I am having a really hard time, especially just mostly with human interaction. When it comes to, you know, if I'm cooking or I'm, you know, cleaning, I'm not distracted really, because those are like real things that I'm doing, I would be doing alone anyways, you know.
So do you mean when you're on the screen for a long time?
Well, it feels like screens are a lot of the human interaction they make up a lot of the human interaction nowadays. And it feels artificial, kind of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It can be upsetting when we can't be with each other, and we can only be with each other like little postage stamps like this.
Yeah.
It's a little odd.
Yeah.
It's but I think all we can do, well, maybe the most important thing we can do, is just simply remind ourselves, this is the best we can do right now. Mm-hmm. There's no way to improve this that we know of at this point. We just have to make the best of this. And look on the positive side and the bright side of it. We do have the opportunity, like right now, to see each other. Many of us are separated from each other long distances.
Yeah.
Many miles, but we have a chance to be with each other, and even in this limited postage stamp way. And that's kind of a blessing. You know, technology has given us at least that.
That's true.
Hi, David. I don't know where you are, but I think you're far away. Teresa, I know, is far away.
Very
far. And many of us are a long distance from each other. But we have a chance to be with each other in this limited way. Now, I always remind myself of that. But it can be hard adjusting to this lonely world, and world where we don't have the warmth that comes from our human contact with each other. But we do the best we can. Thank you. Yes, Dave.
Good evening, Les. It's very good to hear you give a Dharma talk. And for me, attending Kanando by Zoom is very much revisiting my roots. I started meditation and Buddhism at Kanando, and I have taken a rather gypsy-like ride through many other Buddhist denominations and practices. And I'm using this opportunity to get back in touch with how I started with it all. And yes, the spending too much time in front of Zoom is a problem, but given that this is the best we can do, I want to say that my experience of touching base with the Kanando practice, the flavor of the Kanando community, even though it's a bunch of new people mostly, has for me been very successful. And you're right, the long distance participation is a real advantage. So I appreciate everybody there keeping the home fires burning, as it were, or the cushions moldering or whatever. In other words, in many ways, it is working for me in unexpected and pretty remarkable ways. And I appreciate all that. And I appreciate you folks. Thank you.
Good. Are there any other comments or questions?
Teresa?
I want to second what David just said, and since tomorrow will be Thanksgiving in the US. I want to say thank you to you, Les, and to all of you. I can't imagine this year without this. It's been a great support in my life. So thank you.
Any other questions? Well, thank you, Les, for a wonderful talk.
This talk was brought to you by the Canandoe Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.